Thank you, Rob. I suppose you could say that we've reached the stage where I'm always in danger of having to say, but I repeat myself. Anyway, among the many things that I try to avoid are avocados, anchovies, root canals, and assigned sermon topics. So when I was invited to speak to you this morning and told that your monthly theme was mercy, I had to ponder the matter for a few moments before saying yes. Although I have touched on the theme of mercy in previous sermons, it's not one of my major themes. I've never devoted an entire sermon to the topic. So I had to determine whether I was more drawn to laziness than curiosity before accepting the invitation, or asking if I could be invited perhaps some other month when your theme might be Iceland or religious humanism or some other such topic. When I do agree to address a theme that I have not undertaken so directly before, it's my common practice, my typical practice, to turn to the sermon collections of Unitarian Universalist ministers and other religious liberals that line the bookshelves of my study, looking for insight and inspiration, seeking to discern what it is that the great Unitarian Universalists and other religious liberals of the past have had to say on a particular topic or theme. I don't fancy myself so wise or insightful that I can ever approach a topic without consulting those who have come before, the great cloud of witnesses who have pondered the weightiest of the world's questions far more deeply than I have. Now, that collection of sermons on my bookshelves amounts to about 200 volumes or more, not including the ones I have boxed up and banished to the basement. Volumes I no longer access on any kind of regular basis, but because I knew the author or once used a volume, I can't quite bring myself to discard it, particularly as I compete for my own contestant position on a show like Hoarders. So I went through volume by volume, taking it off my shelf, checking the index, thumbing through the table of contents, and I found exactly one sermon in all of those volumes that addressed the subject of mercy explicitly. And in that case, it was just one illustration among half a dozen in a 100-year-old sermon on the Beatitudes. When I turn to the equally copious number of books of prayers, meditations, and liturgical readings, I was met with a similar result. I did find many mentions of the word mercy, which were quickly skipped over. They were just that, mentions, not explorations in any depth, but rather simply the utterance of the word, usually in a triad of words that were meant to make us feel kind and generous, warm and fuzzy. They were mentioned and then glossed over on the assumption that, of course, we all know what we mean when we say mercy, don't we? We all know what we mean when we say love, or when we talk about beauty, or when we insist upon justice. We all know exactly what we mean. So what more needs to be said than the magical word itself? In fact, the word mercy appears more as a poetic buzzword than a central concern to ever be explored in depth. One has to go back to the 19th century to see much talk about mercy in Unitarian pulpits. And even then, it is scarce. It was uttered more frequently in Universalist pulpits, but almost always from the perspective of God's grace and generosity towards us, not in terms of our relations with one another. More than a century ago, Stopford Brooke, a Unitarian minister who was, among other things, chaplain to Queen Victoria, lamented the loss of love and mercy, even the scorn for it, which for 50 years have prevailed more and more in Europe and North America. And the scorn of it was just getting started in that period. Now we have moved far beyond scorn to simply not paying much attention at all. Forgiveness, which is related to mercy but by no means identical with it, fares somewhat better in Unitarian pulpits, but it's still nowhere on the top 40 list of sermons being preached in a congregation near you, or rather far from you either. John Burens, a former president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, once speculated that our avoidance of this subject might be in part a consequence of our humanistic and optimistic temperament. That's putting a good spin on it. He went on to suggest we may want to avoid the less attractive side of human nature, including our own, the part that raises the question of forgiveness in the first place. Call it a doctrine of sin or just a shared sense of fallibility, but it's a little hard to imagine a coherent set of standards of forgiveness without one. The same goes for mercy, I suspect. Given our dismissal of traditional doctrines of sin and evil, which we have seemingly replaced with the idea of human growth and perfectibility, if not outright perfectionism, there's simply less that invokes the need for forgiveness or mercy, or so we think. What I have observed over the past 35 years or so is an increased emphasis in Unitarian Universalist circles on compassion, which, like forgiveness, is related to mercy, but not identical with it. This has been a natural development following the adoption in 1985 of our current statement of principles, the second of which affirms the value of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. By the way, here's a bit of historical trivia for you to carry in your hearts and nurture. It was Linda Weaver Horton, who served our congregations in Saskatoon, West Vancouver, and Kelowna, who was the principal advocate for including the word compassion in that principle. It wasn't there in the original draft. We were going to simply be just and equitable, with all the threat and risk that that implies. As constructed, this principle curiously echoes the Hebrew prophet Micah's injunction to do justice and love mercy, or to love kindness, as some versions put it. And so, as I understand it, mercy is related to kindness, to forgiveness, and to compassion, all three, but with a twist. Whatever else it may be, mercy is forgiveness from a position of power. The power differential may be relative and entirely situational, but it is the key ingredient that distinguishes mercy from the other three. Mercy is also compassion extended without judgment. or more commonly, despite judgment. It is kindness given not randomly, but precisely, whether or not it's deserved. Mercy calls us to active compassion towards those who are within our reach, not only when it's easy or convenient or even merited, but most especially when it is difficult. And whether we wish to admit it or not, it does involve those virtues and a degree of power. As I say, it isn't necessarily some sort of absolute power, politically, economically, socially. Anyone who has raised a teenager will understand that sometimes it is our own teenage children who occupy the seat of power in the relationship. Or even, well, a dog, having become the grandfather of a Basenji 5 years ago, a breed that is particularly noted for its stubbornness and willfulness, which is to say, its wonderful and rich sense of self. I have learned while walking the dog that sometimes it's the dog that walks me. And I have often found myself begging for mercy when the dog intends to continue going down the street and I just want to go home. Because, well, as I've learned as I've aged, dogs aren't the only creatures that sometimes have to pee. So there's an element of power, and that's actually why I like Shakespeare's reading, because it acknowledges that mercy involves some degree of power, and not even the king or the queen is above the call to mercy. Mercy can be dispensed as much by a king as by a pauper, as much by a wealthy person as by the person we meet on the street. And so I think that's an essential characteristic, and it influences the way we tend to think about mercy. Because of course, while it's allied with forgiveness, it's not the same, because not every time we're called to mercy involves an offense that we're being called to forgive. Sometimes there's nothing to forgive, save perhaps for a social ill. And sometimes it's just a truly random act of kindness that leads us in the direction of mercy. So I've been thinking about this. Why is it that in more than a century, mercy has literally, by which I mean figuratively, fallen off the shelf in terms of pulpit orations by Unitarian Universalist ministers and indeed across the liberal religious spectrum? Why is it that we don't talk about mercy more? Is it that we somehow believe that we're not worthy of it? Is it perhaps that somehow we believe we're too good for it? Is it because it's inconvenient? Or perhaps it's because acts of mercy require us to acknowledge the inequity of power structures and opportunity within our society. When we are called to be merciful, among the things we do in extending mercy is come face to face with our own privilege and advantage. Maybe it's just that we've become largely post-biblical. If you look through anthologies beyond Unitarian Universalist sermons, if you go to Bartlett's Book of Quotations or if you go to an online website on quotations, if you just thumb through volumes that touch on mercy, almost inevitably, the references are biblical. And so it turns out that the Bible is a wealthy store of messages on mercy, and that proves inconvenient for the modern Unitarian Universalist who often wishes to live without any personal relationship with the Bible. Bring on the sutras. Let's talk about the sayings of Confucius. Let's consider indigenous spirituality or the musings of wise prophets and philosophers from the past, but please spare us the Bible. However, that's where a lot of the rich stuff about mercy is. And so I would ask you to forgive me the fact that the rest of this sermon is going to be biblical. I might even beg your mercy, but I'm not going to. You brought it on yourselves, and your selection of this theme is a judgment. And I am here to address the rest of the morning through three biblical passages that in fact illustrate this theme of mercy. The first is the classic. And let me introduce it by saying that it's been my privilege during a long and satisfying ministerial career to visit hundreds of Unitarian Universalist congregations in North America and Europe. That's no exaggeration. I've visited probably a third of the congregations that are out there. In the ones who exist that exist in older buildings, let's say, curiously enough, those that were built in the 1920s or earlier, which seems to be the preaching cutoff point, there are often biblical passages inscribed on the wall. Now, if you visit a Unitarian Universalist congregation that was built since the 1950s, if anything is written on the wall, other than the words restroom, if anything is written on the wall, it's going to be something from Khalil Gibran's The Prophet, or perhaps from Max Ehrmann's Desiderata. It will be something of that nature. But if you go back a century and more, Unitarian and Universalist congregations wrote Bible verses on the wall, often arched over the front of the chancel. In historically Universalist churches, the most common one is God is love. In fact, some people used to wonder about my church in Aarberg, Manitoba, where we had a God is love banner to the very end, hanging in the front of that congregation, a reflection of its history. Do you have any idea what verse appears most commonly on the walls of historic Unitarian churches? I won't ask you to unmute. Do you have any idea? It's Micah 6:8. Almost always in the language of the King James Version, what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justice and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God? It's along the East Coast. It's along the West Coast. It can be found in historic churches in the U.S. South, historic Unitarian churches. It can be found in the upper Midwest, and at one time it could be found on the old Unitarian church in Montreal and the old Unitarian church in Toronto and in many of the congregations here on the prairies. What doth the Lord require of thee but to do justice and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God? It was considered to actually distill the essence of what Unitarians were about. Today, the language seems dated to us. For some who may still have tender feelings about the larger Christian tradition, it may even be alien or offensive. But it was at the heart of Unitarianism a century ago and earlier. It was also at the heart of the work of Jane Addams, the great social reformer who was associated with Hull House in Chicago. She was not a Unitarian, although we have sometimes tried to appropriate her on those t-shirts that list famous Unitarians from the past, but she was a kindred spirit. She devoted her time and attention in Chicago to working in the city's most desperate communities, dealing on a day-to-day basis with poverty, with families who were disrupted by circumstances that they could not have reasonably planned for, with people who were oppressed by racism and classism, with all manner of people who were struggling just to get by. She understood her work in Chicago as a work of mercy. And she understood the purpose of Hull House to be about bringing mercy to the most disadvantaged citizens of that city. And she understood that she was doing so from a position of power. Oh, how she lamented the inequities of power. How she lamented the disparity of economic well-being. How she lamented the fact that so many people led lives beyond their own control. And yet she understood that she occupied a position of privilege. And she said that that passage from Micah was central to being able to resolve the conflicts and tensions, because absolute mercy without any correction runs the risk of making people dependent or even allowing them to take advantage of you. Similarly, absolute justice breeds new injustices. That if all we ever do is to seek justice as old Nebuchadnezzar would have had us do, we end up with a lot of people without eyes and ears and fingers. That sometimes justice needs to be tempered with mercy. And in her case, she understood that there was something transcendent that held that conflict together. For Jane Addams, that was God. For many, probably most Unitarian Universalists, that no longer works. But I can tell you that there is some value in your life that motivates you and drives you, and it may as well be called God for the impact that it has on how you live. The truth of the matter is that our gods really are created and empowered largely by us. And if you want to know what anyone considers to be God, just look for what it is that they appear to worship. This weekend, for many, it is shamefully a golden trump. How much better it is if the thing that you would be accused of worshiping were something like love or justice, especially if that justice were tempered by mercy. Another important passage is, of course, the 23rd Psalm, which most of us know by heart, particularly if we are of a particular vintage, when it was at least inflicted upon us in school, if not at church. Most of us know it by heart, and the words are familiar, and most of us seek to escape it. And yet there's a power. In his commentary on the 23rd Psalm, which includes the familiar line, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life," Rabbi Harold S. Kushner says, "Whole books have been written about the meaning of the Hebrew word hesed, here translated as mercy, more commonly rendered as loving kindness. I like to think of hesed as unearned love," he said. "In interpersonal terms, it asks us to go beyond the letter of the law in order to fashion a more human world. It asks us to do things for others that we don't have to do, and that the other might not deserve, but we should do them anyway." Kushner points out parenthetically that mercy does not demand because love cannot be commanded. I like this notion of mercy as unearned love. That's what was motivating Jane Addams. I think that's what was motivating my mother on many occasions when I didn't deserve mercy, but I received it. Curiously, Kushner also notes that the passage, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me," is better translated as, "Surely goodness and mercy shall pursue me." Whether or not it's reasonable to expect it, the psalmist saw mercy as an act of good, not merely some sort of passive blessing. As he sees it, if we were to stop pursuing happiness and success as strenuously as we sometimes do, if we could get out of our own sense of self-importance and entitlement and simply relax, then goodness and mercy would find their way into our lives. Now, I find this too optimistic by half, so I'm not convinced, but there's always a but. It does reinforce for me the sense that mercy as unearned love cannot be coerced, cannot be demanded, cannot be expected. It comes to us, or we extend it to others, independent of any merit. There isn't an account ledger involved. And the corollary of this is that just because we ourselves may be merciful, it doesn't follow that we'll be thanked for it. An act of mercy may be rejected. It may be twisted and exploited. It may be received by another without the smallest hint of gratitude on their part. If we engage in acts of mercy for the reward of congratulation and thanks, we will be sorely disappointed. I'm more convinced by Kushner's observation that the psalmist assertion is both an expression of hope that people will treat him mercifully and a prayer that he will be blessed with the capacity to be merciful, to be forgiving all the days of his life. He understands the psalm as a vision of the world where goodness and mercy shall characterize every stage of the lifespan. That is, where children and youth won't bully one another out of their own insecurities, where spouses won't keep score about the other's shortcomings, where neighbors won't enforce every imagined boundary, where employers won't record every mistake or absence, where the elderly won't find themselves belittled and sidelined by the impatience of a world that moves more quickly than they do. That's mercy. And finally, the big one, the one from the Beatitudes, my third and final illustration of mercy from the Bible. If you remember, or if you're at least merciful enough to pretend you do, there was only one Unitarian minister who addressed mercy directly and at some length in the many volumes of sermons I glanced at in seeking some hint of inspiration from our tradition for this morning. And to find that sermon, I had to reach back a full century to a 1922 anthology, Magic Wells by Julian C. James, which came out the year its author died. Now, if that name seems familiar to you, he was the father of the psychologist of the same name who achieved fame in 1976 with his book, The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. I suppose that some of you may have read that book. In any event, Julian James addressed mercy in a rather lengthy sermon about the Beatitudes, which he sought to explore verse by verse. And if you felt I've gone on too long already, just imagine sitting through a sermon 100 years ago where mercy was the fifth of six illustrations on the Beatitudes. And you will feel, or may feel, that I've been merciful. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy, says the Beatitude. At first glance, this may seem as though mercy involved some sort of quid pro quo, which would undermine Kushner's understanding of mercy as unearned love. But this is not the case, which is just as well, since we would quickly be disappointed if we were ever to expect someone like the subject who inspired the before mentioned Golden Trump to be merciful in response to the countless mercies from which he himself has benefited. No, said Julian James, this beatitude does not mean that if you are merciful to others, they will be merciful to you. For experience proves time and again that people of the more charitable spirit are often judged by others with the most relentless harshness. It does not mean that you are to be generous, that you are to be generous in your judgments, with the expectation of getting something in return, said James. One example comes immediately to mind. The judge who extends mercy to a criminal after conviction who goes on to reoffend. This is every judge's career nightmare. First, the judge receives the wrath of the victims who perceive the act of mercy as an affront to justice. I can testify to this personally because I had a somewhat distant cousin murdered in Iceland, and the judge was merciful because of the obvious mental illness of the man who committed the murder. But that does not mean that my family back in Iceland was in any way pleased with the judge's merciful verdict and sentencing. Then the judge sees the lack of gratitude, remorse, and learning on the part of one who reoffends. And then the judge experiences a new wave of public criticism about the original act of mercy, which is retroactively found wanting. The judge can't win by being merciful. And yet a good judge will be merciful anyway. An example closer to home may be the way in which we judge our Facebook friends and, for better or worse, extend mercy towards them for their social media foibles, a tendency that has left many a career in ruin, including, well, my own political career. Mercifulness is its own reward, says Julian James, and unmercifulness is its own punishment. He intimated that being judging and unforgiving, unsympathetic and unmerciful was a sure prescription for being unhappy. The person is always judging others while failing to extend mercy. This person lives the detective's life, full of suspicion and morbid watchfulness, seeking the diseased motives and sickening errors of humanity, and surrounded by the iron implements of the fault finder's trade. By contrast, those who hold to a generous interpretation of life and a recognition of human foibles and their equitable distribution will radiate mercy and find quiet joy in doing so, despite everything that may disappoint them and disturb their better judgment. As Shakespeare wrote, the quality of mercy is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. If we're going to be criticized and demonized anyway, let us choose to be criticized and demonized for our quality of mercy, for being excessively merciful when we might have been otherwise. We will discover that we are among the twice blessed, for being merciful will make us kinder, gentler, more compassionate, more forgiving, and ultimately even happier for the quality of our own mercy. Blessed be.